We are now in the book of Acts, chapter 16, and verse 9. And a vision appeared to Paul in the night. There stood a man of Macedonia and prayed him, saying, "Come over into Macedonia and help us." Now, the word vision is horama, H-O-R-A-M-A. And it just means, very simply, that which is seen. And since it's a vision that comes to Paul in the night, it may have been a dream. Since it mentions in the night, it may have been a dream. We can't prove that from that phrase, but that at least is a good possibility. And there stood a man of Macedonia, and I think he probably knew this was a man of Macedonia by his dress, and maybe by his accent. I don't think that he had a big sign written there on his chest, "I'm a man of Macedonia." But I'm certain there were things in the vision, in that which he was seeing and experiencing in this, that he knew this was a man of Macedonia. And I think it was very, very clear to him exactly what those things were, though we don't know. And this one is saying, "Come over into Macedonia and help us." It's a pleading. It comes as a cry of desperation. It shows the people having a great need, and God is going to send Paul to meet the need. When it comes from a man of Macedonia, then that's really going to appeal to Paul's heart. It isn't just God saying, "Go to Macedonia." It's a man of Macedonia saying, "Come and help us." That would really impact Paul's heart. When you find out somebody wants you to minister to them, wants you to witness to them, that's like saying, "Stick them to a hound dog." I mean, you're off and you're there on their doorstep. When it's kind of the Lord telling us, sometimes it's a little bit harder, you know, and we're learning to respond in either case, whatever the case might be. But I think this was something that would really pull much more upon Paul. Rather than God just saying, "Go," he sees a person in that country in need. So that would, in a certain sense, more fully impact his heart. There are definite reasons why God does the things the way that he does them. And maybe for where Paul was, and just was maybe a little bit leery about those people being receptive to the gospel or whatever, this is what he needed. He needed this call to come in this fashion. God will present his call to you in the fashion that you need it. And that's what he's doing here. And I think it's significant. It's a small point, but I think it's a significant point. It's interesting to see the way God does things. God does not do things the way that we would necessarily think that he would. He knows what is needed. He knows how to communicate these things. It's interesting when he gives Jeremiah two visions. He says, "Jeremiah, what do you see?" He asked Jeremiah to tell him what he sees. And that implies that a person can wrongly interpret or wrongly view certain visions. And when he tells him what he sees, he says, "You've seen well." That's very, very interesting. That's a very interesting thing. And we don't know much about these things. We don't have volumes that document all the visions that we have had individually and all the dreams and ways in which we've experienced God. We have not experienced that much of God up to this point in time. And so if we can see the way God works with others, so we get a proper framework, so to speak, in our mind, so we better understand ways in which God will work, then when God does, things won't come as being so peculiar. This really helps us to better be able to receive what God's going to do in and through us in the future. Whereas a lot of these things, people don't study these things and have no familiarity whatsoever the way God does things, it's very easy for them to interpret that as not being God. very easy, because it does seem kind of strange. And would he do it this way? All of this sets very important precedences for us. And then we have to realize, though, that this doesn't just then become the full limitation on the way God will work either. But it really does help us overall. Verse 10, and after he had seen the vision, immediately we endeavored to go into Macedonia, assuredly gathering that the Lord had called us for to preach the gospel unto them. Immediately means without hesitation. Right away they set sail for Macedonia. It doesn't mean that he jumped out of bed and they ran down to the ship. But in very short amount of time, they took care of what they had to do and they went right down there without hesitation. In a short amount of time. Now, Macedonia is a province north of Greece. And under Alexander the Great, as well as under Philip, Alexander's father, Macedonia had attained its greatest power. And Greece had put it under their control. It was Alexander's homeland. It's where he'd been raised. And this area had been conquered by Rome in 168 B.C. So probably about 200 plus years before this, Rome had conquered this land. When it says, assuredly gathering that the Lord had called us, it means that they drew this conclusion based on the doors closed, the prayers they'd been praying, this vision, how it bore witness with their spirits, they concluded. And it shows that they used their minds, they made evaluation, they discussed it, they maybe further prayed about it, so to speak, momentarily. They didn't spend a great deal of time if they did pray about it further. I think this is what they'd been asking for, and they knew immediately this was God. They knew it was God. It lined up with what they'd been doing and the ways in which they knew that God would move and the way God had closed these doors. And if God closes certain doors, that means there's got to be other doors that he's going to open. And if all the doors that you would expect him opening are closed, then you have to look for, so to speak, kind of an unexpected door. And he may not have really thought that God would have them go into this area. And so then when this is happening, they know that this is what God wants them to do. And so they conclude that this is the Lord, that it's his will, and so off they go. And verse 11 just says they loosed from Troas. They came with a straight course to Samothracia, the next day to Neapolis, and from thence to Philippi, the chief city of that part of Macedonia. Now Philippi was founded by Philip, who was the father of Alexander the Great, as I mentioned, and this was founded in 356 B.C. This was a gateway city between Asia Minor and the West. And then if you're coming from the West, so to speak, it's the gateway city to Asia Minor. There were four significant events that are going to occur here. Number one, the conversion of Lydia and her household. That's in verses 13 to 15. There's going to be the deliverance of the demon-possessed girl, verses 16 to 18. There's going to be the conversion of the jailer, verses 19 to 34. And then there's going to be the release of Paul and Silas, verses 35 to 40. So Lydia and her household, the demon-possessed girl, the jailer converted, and the release of Paul and Silas. These four things are going to take place here. Verse 13, and on the Sabbath we went out of the city by a riverside where prayer was wont to be made, and we sat down and spake unto the women which resorted thither. They went out looking for a place to pray, and they found these ladies here, probably Jews, as well as proselytes to Judaism, and they gathered here for special times of prayer and worship. Now, I think that this was at times when the synagogue services had already been concluded. And so they may have also gone to the synagogues. But then they decided to go outside the city and find a place to pray. And I think more in effect, they kind of stumbled on this group of women. Since these women are out here at an unorthodox time to be praying, it shows that they have a real heart for God. There are things that God is orchestrating that we don't even know that He's moving. We don't even recognize His hand upon us, but God is moving here. He's putting it in Paul and Silas's hearts to just go out and pray for a while, and they run across these ladies. And it turns into a tremendous opportunity to witness for Jesus Christ. Now, it is a possibility, though, that they had to gather outside the city because maybe the authorities would not allow Jews to meet in the city. That's a possibility. I think that they were undoubtedly allowed to gather in the city, but then their normal meeting times, that had already come and gone, but yet they still wanted to go out and pray. And so they're out here demonstrating their real heart for God. God sees that and sends Paul and Silas their way, even though Paul and Silas don't know they're going to stumble upon this group of people. And I think that's maybe a better way to interpret it. We're not really told, we're not given enough information to come to any sort of absolute conclusion. Verse 14, and a certain woman named Lydia, a seller of purple of the city of Thyatira, which worshipped God, heard us, whose heart the Lord opened, that she attended unto the things that were spoken of Paul. Now, she's a seller of purple. The city of Thyatira is known for its purple dyes. And so, since she is from that city, then you can see the connection as to why she'd be a seller of purple. And so that's just a kind of an interesting historical, archaeological fact. And it mentions her heart being opened, whose heart the Lord opened. Now, this is not Calvinism. It isn't her heart was closed and God just came down and forced it open. He says, your heart's going to be open whether you like it or not, and barges in. That's not what happens. It's showing that Jesus was able to do this because she was a worshiper of God. God always initiates these things, and then He takes advantage of our response. So God has been working through Judaism, undoubtedly through Judaism, to draw upon this person, just like He did with Cornelius and with others. And she's wanting God, and she's worshiping God as best as she knows how. So God's been wooing her, drawing her, and she's been responding. So based on all of that and the responses she's been making, now when the gospel is preached, the Lord is able to open her heart because she's responding. He's also able to open her heart because she listens to Paul. God can do a lot if we just listen. If we just keep listening to our pastor, just keep listening to those that God has put over us, it's amazing how much more He can open our hearts. And really, it's an amazing thing how God can do this. In all of this, we see her humility, and we see that she's acknowledging her need, acknowledgement of need. So the whole thing, we see a proper response, so therefore God is able to do further things. See, when it says that she attended unto the things which were spoken of Paul, attended, the Greek shows her really paying attention. She was concentrating upon Paul's words. These things are all working hand in hand. They work back and forth. And that's how God was able to open her heart. Wasn't it God just opened her heart based on her response? He is moving first. She responds, so therefore He's able to do more. That's the way it always is. It's always that way. There's no exceptions to that. That's the way God always works. He always takes the first step. And then as we respond, He's able to take others and do more. And if we respond, He's able to do further upon that. That's the way it always is. And It's never just somehow, well, this person just happened to have this happen, or God just reached out and did this, and somehow now God's being unfair, and why doesn't he do it to me? It says, if we seek him with all our heart, we'll find him. And there's no exception. There is no exception. None whatsoever. And we need to really realize that. Because if we don't keep coming to that revelation, we're going to find all sorts of lies, wrong concepts, perverted thoughts, and different things, more or less, that say that God is shunning us. God doesn't really want us. He won't make a way for us. And they'll be very subtle things. They can be disastrous. Verse 15, and when she was baptized in her household, she besought us, saying, if ye have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come into my house and abide there. And she constraineth us. She constrained us. She just wanted to show hospitality. She wanted to show her love. She probably also wanted him to do more preaching. Probably a number of motives here. A number of things happening. And she used some, you know, some real feminine strategy, saying, now, if you judge me faithful to the things of the Lord, well then, why don't you come over to my house and let me feed you, and of course I'd be glad to have you answer some more of my questions and help me to better understand these things I don't understand. And I'm sure she came across in a very demure and feminine and, you know, sweet way, and I don't think Paul was able to say no, and they probably enjoyed a very relaxing time. And he's just making the whole thing, he's just showing that this is something that really happened and that we're dealing with real people and real events. And he gives us a few of the other highlights. God doesn't just give us all the spiritual things and that's it. He gives us some of the other things that make it interesting and kind of delightful, and other things that add to the whole account. Verse 16, and it came to pass, as we went to prayer, a certain damsel, possessed with the spirit of divination, met us, which brought her masters much gain by soothsaying. So, I think that this may be, as far as the way in which this is happening, very possibly they're going again out to the riverside to pray, or maybe to some other location to pray, and as they're going to just pray, they have this event take place. They run across this damsel who's demon-possessed. And I think, again, it shows that as people are just doing God's will, God isn't telling us day by day what we're going to run across, who we're going to contact. Jesus didn't wake up in the morning and God from heaven handed down his daily itinerary. That's not what happened. It never happens like that. Now, there may be certain times that he gives certain things that will take place, just like God did with William Branham and gave him some very amazing visions that showed exact things that were going to take place. And so God will do that. But overall, he just says, you live for me and I'll take care of the day. And I've got some things for you. But I'd rather not tell you about him right now. You might not get out of bed if I did. So you just live for me, and I know how to orchestrate these things. And it'll be a blessing. It'll be a delight. It'll bring glory to my name. And so you just trust me. And see, that's the way this is being shown here. They felt a certain need to go pray, and then this thing happens, and winning this household, and now they're feeling another need to go pray, and then this thing takes place. Well, you're just on your way to your job, or you're on your way to church, and you're out on this witnessing team, and it's quite amazing to see all the different things that happen, 99% of which we would have never anticipated, we would have never imagined, we would have never thought this could lead to this or this could have happened, and we're going to see this much more so, especially when we're in the full-time ministry. That's what God is calling us to, you know, individually. And as we're in part-time ministries, we find these things happening that we wouldn't have anticipated. And God's able to do it because we're doing his will. We're just out living for him and serving him. Now, the word damsel just means a servant girl or a slave girl. Spirit of divination literally is spirit of Python. Doesn't sound too good, does it? In Greek mythology, this was the name of a dragon slain by Apollo. Then the name was later applied to Apollo. And then later the word was applied to diviners, regarded as inspired by Apollo. And these people were demon-possessed. And this is one of these demon-possessed people. And they were very much opposed to God. So here, what it means is, this is one who is inspired by Apollo. And that is, by demons. And she's involved in soothsaying. So it says, which brought her masters much gain by soothsaying. This is the practice of divination. That is, uttering words from a god, of which is from a demon. And she is just like Simon in Acts chapter 8. Simon there that Philip met was involved in the same thing. Then verse 17, the same followed Paul and us and cried, saying, these men are the servants of the Most High God, which show unto us the way of salvation. The question is, why is she doing this? Because this sounds like a pretty good testimonial. She's giving what sounds like the right kind of honor, respect, accolades for Paul and his ministry and for his companions. Well, my assessment is that the demons involved were trying very cleverly to associate themselves with Paul and these others. Paul, Silas, as well as evidently Luke, because of the pronoun us, and I'm not sure exactly where Timothy is in all of this. I think he's involved here as well. Kind of hard to keep track of all the different people that are making up this journey. But the pronoun us does show that Luke is involved. And we'll notice later the pronouns change. And shows Luke, the penman here, he's involved in this. And I think that these demons are doing, in effect, what has happened with a lot of Roman Catholic priests, which is, in my estimation, the same thing, where they have acknowledged the charismatic movement, acknowledged speaking in tongues, so that they can still maintain control over those of their parish, over their parishioners. And these demons have controlled these people in this city, in this location. And they're using subtlety to maintain control. I think the demons are saying, well, we could... See, they've got strategy. They sit down, so to speak, at their planning table, lay out their game plan, decide what they're going to do. They don't just work haphazardly. They make decisions. They decide what would be best. We know that's what they do. And they don't just, on the spur of the moment, do something. They talk it over, discuss it, you know, in whatever way they go about that. And so they could say, well, we could use the direct opposition approach and just denounce this. We can use the ignore them approach. Or we can use one of our more clever strategies, and we will align with them. That's no problem to demons. They'll align with anything. Like communists, they'll align with anything. Anything that works, they'll align with it and use it to their advantage. And there's a lot of people like that. That's what con artists do. Yeah. I mean, it's a very common practice. It's not some strange, bizarre thing. And so I think in this case, they decide, well, we'll use this method so that when these men are finally gone, because they're not going to be here for an indefinite period of time, they're going to have to go somewhere else. And they've seen Paul traveling. And they know that, for the most part, God has had them move on and haven't stayed there for years and years and years. So, well, they've been moving rather quickly from city to city. Once they leave and we've aligned with them, then those people will think that what we have done is really of their theology, of their belief, and will once again be able to control the people. And it doesn't bother the demons either to have people get saved, align with Christ, and align with the demons as well. Because they know in the long run, they'll be able to win. Because when you mix those two together, the devil has too great of an advantage. And the devil doesn't mind somebody getting saved as long as they put one foot in Christianity and leave the other foot in the world. because in about 99% of those cases, they're going to win out again. Just like getting somebody delivered, but you don't really get that which you need put back in. You got that nice swept house, but what comes back? What happens to the person? They end up in a worse state. Those demons come back again. So I think this is the kind of strategy here, and I think it's a very clever thing. Now, Paul, by the Spirit, recognizes what's happening, and he will not accept the testimony of demons. We do not want demons patting us on the back. We don't want part of what is our, what verifies our ministry is a testimony of demons. We don't want to be putting out a book, you know, and then who writes the reviews for the book? And we want all sorts of Christians, and then we want all sorts of secular sources, and sometimes we want all sorts of demonic sources verifying that we have a good book, good ministry. That's not what we're looking for. Jesus would not accept the testimony of demons either. He told him to be quiet. Mark chapter 1, that was a polite way. He didn't say it quite that way either, but that was a polite way of saying it. Mark 1 and verse 25. He would not accept their testimony. Again, it was more of the strategy of aligning with and then being able to take advantage later on. These wicked spirits are very clever. And they would have ended up with control over the people. So it's got to be made very clear who's who, which side is which. I think that's what's happening here.
I believe it was this pastor that had said in another class that what she was actually saying is they show us a way of salvation.
Mm-hmm. As far as the Greek. Mm-hmm. But the people listening there that weren't discerning, they would have never caught the distinction. They would have never caught it. And I'm not sure how strong a point we can make. All we can make basically from the Greek is that it doesn't say they show the way. As far as putting in an indefinite article A, we can't just do that from the Greek, because there's a number of cases where you don't have a definite article. That doesn't mean you can put in an indefinite article. Best example is John chapter 1, verse 1. We don't say, now because the Logos is God, and it doesn't say the Logos is the God, it means the Logos is a God. Because it doesn't have the definite article, doesn't mean we put in a or an. But yes, exactly, to make Jesus a lesser God. So in this case, that's be about all we can say, is that it doesn't say the way. But to those just listening who weren't really aware of what was being said, it would have just been way of salvation, and that would have been enough to trap them. That would have been enough aligning with this that once Paul and the others were gone, I think they would have still had an advantage over the people. But it's an interesting point. And that, to my mind, shows further the subtlety of the enemy.
Yeah.
But he knows what he's saying. He knows what he's having this one under his inspiration say. And he's not going to be real quick to say these people have the way of salvation. As far as the way he's going to say it, it's going to just be way of salvation. And then however the person interprets it is kind of up to them. And if his demons are impacting their mind, well, it's going to end up with this kind of interpretation. And if the Holy Spirit isn't able to get in and make the point clear, well, it just keeps a strong advantage for the enemy in these people's lives. So it's a very interesting account. And then notice this went on for many days. It didn't just, and it wasn't, it just happened once. I don't think necessarily Paul right away knew what to do. It says, but Paul being grieved turned and said to the Spirit, I command thee in the name of Jesus Christ to come out of her. And it came out the same hour. Now, this thing was weighing upon Paul, and he ended up being grieved by this whole thing. But it is possible that at first, as this was happening, he may not have known what to do about it. We don't know really what was taking place. We can sometimes be in situations where we just do not recognize what is really happening. We don't have such total discernment on all things that we can read all situations and therefore also know what to do in all situations. Sometimes we can know basically what is going on, but we still don't really know what to do. And this may have struck him in his spirit, and he may have known, and I'm sure that he did right away, that there's a problem here. But he probably, at that point, didn't know what to do. And so he had to keep praying about the matter. And he finally understood what he was to do. He was to rebuke that demon and command it to leave. Now, that does not mean, though, she got saved. And it doesn't mean that demon didn't come back. It made it clear who was who. And now it's going to be an entirely different matter as to whether or not she gets saved. And that's not addressed. So we don't know what happens to this lady. She's been a pawn of the devil. God comes on the scene to deliver her, but whether or not she opens up to salvation, we don't know. And I'm not going to assume one way or the other, because we're just not given enough data. So then, her masters are real happy with this, and they catch Paul and Silas to give them a big reward. No, they take them into the marketplace before the rulers, and the whole picture is that they drag them violently into an open place in the center of the city. The marketplace speaks of the town square. Verse 20, and brought them to the magistrates, saying, "These men, being Jews, do exceedingly trouble our city." Do exceedingly trouble, literally, are throwing into utter disorder our city. Now, see, that's not true. They're just really perturbed that now their means of making money and controlling people has at least for this time been brought to a screeching halt. And this is not setting real well with them in their minds and hearts. And so they're exaggerating. Then he goes on and he says in verse 21, and teach customs which are not lawful for us to receive, neither to observe, being Romans. Now, this phrase, being Romans, it's giving the idea that, see, they're not really Romans. They're not really Romans. The people in this province of Macedonia, they are not really Romans. But now they're, and I don't think these ones really were. They're not from Italy. They're Romans because Rome is controlling. This is just like the Jews. Same thing. When it was to their advantage to appeal to Rome, they appealed to Rome. When it was to their advantage to say, we're not going to have anything to do with Rome, that's the way they handled the situation. The same thing is here taking place. Now, Judaism was tolerated and protected in the empire. Its followers, though, were not allowed to make proselytes of Romans. And so they're saying, well, we're under Roman control, therefore we're Romans, and they're trying to make proselytes of us. Now, what does Rome think about that? Now, that's not how they're really viewing the thing in any way whatsoever. But they're just trying to get rid of Paul and Silas. They're just liars. They're not real patriots. They try to act like real patriots. We're trying to defend Rome. We're Romans. We're under Roman control. Look what the people are doing to Rome. They could care less what the people are doing to Rome. They're upset because their means of making money has somehow been taken away from them. That's what's causing them to be mad. The demons are upset. Demons are liars. These people are liars. They got demons lying right through them. They don't care about Rome. They're not Romans. They're not patriotic. They would just as soon see Rome burn, just like the Jews would. No country likes to be under anybody else's control. Nobody. But when they can use it to their advantage, they will. Very, very common thing throughout all the history of the human race. The multitude rose up together against them, and the magistrates rent off their clothes and commanded to beat them. They stripped them. It's a great public shame. And the word to beat means to beat with rods. So taking a whip, some sort of a stick, whatever it was exactly. This happened three times to Paul, 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 25. And this is improper treatment of Paul because Paul is a Roman citizen. But there wasn't any way at this point for him to really make an appeal. And maybe he didn't feel to make an appeal. We don't really know what's going on in his mind. But in verses 37 and 38, he lets them know that he's a Roman. And the people end up in great fear because if he makes an appeal and Rome finds out about what has happened to one of their citizens, even though the citizen is a Jew, they will come down very hard upon the people involved here. But he doesn't make any mention of it right now. And when they had laid many stripes upon them, they cast him into prison, charging the jailer to keep them safely. So they throw him into prison after beating them. Who received such a charge, thrust them into the inner prison. When it said, now you make sure they don't escape, he put them into the top security prison area. The inner prison means a prison within a prison, the securest part of the prison. And he put their feet fast in the stocks, and these stocks are made with more than two holes, and that's so that the legs could be forced as wide apart as possible. So then just have two holes, and if you're real long leg, then oh, this will be fine, no problem. But if you're real short and stout, ooh, what a big problem. No, a lot of holes, so no matter height, size of legs, length, or anything else, it's going to be painful. And it was very painful indeed. And also, this prison did not have hot and cold running water, ideal restroom facilities, color TV, visiting privileges, and the Civil Liberties Union there to plead their case. It's dark, it's damp, and it's filthy. This is not really what people are bargaining for when they say, I'll take up the cross and follow Jesus, but this does happen. And so they bemoaned their situation and gave in to all demons of self-pity and said, woe be unto us. Well, they could have, though. Sure they could have. Anybody could have. We might. Hopefully we won't, though. Hopefully we'll do what Paul and Silas do. They pray. They prayed some honest prayers. Lord, help us. And then they, after praying for a while, and I'm sure they prayed like that, and they asked God for strength to see him through. And they may have had a lot of demons attacking them, various kinds of fears. And it's not a real pleasant situation. This is not wasn't a surprise birthday party. And everybody was there with smiling faces and giving them pats on the back. The devil's right on the scene here. The devil's a great intimidator, and he's trying to intimidate in every way possible. And so they pray, and then it turns to singing praises. They let faith arise in their hearts. And I think that, see, when it says they sang praises, and when it says, and at midnight, Paul and Silas prayed and sang praises. See, the midnight hour represents the darkest hour of the soul. The midnight hour. The darkest hour. And to my mind, this is what truly proves the reality and the power of the gospel. It shows that the gospel works. And it was a powerful testimony to the other prisoners. You just don't find many people put into the innermost prison in these stocks after being beaten, and they are singing praises to God. They're happy. They're filled with joy. This is not the way it is. So it was a powerful testimony. And then suddenly there's a great earthquake. So the foundations of the prisons were shaken, and immediately all the doors were opened, and everyone's bands were loosed. And so God responds to this entire situation in a rather dynamic way. The bands speaks of the chains by which these prisoners were fastened, probably fastened to the wall or to the floor. And maybe the way the prison walls shook, the way the chains were fixed into the wall, maybe that shook the mortar loose and the chains then fell out of the wall. I don't think it necessarily means the part around the wrist just came off. I think it's more what happened from the earthquake. And they're all probably standing there in kind of dumbfounded amazement that the whole place is shaking, and about all that has happened is all the doors are open, and now our chains are no longer hooked into the walls. It's rather unique. It's quite amazing. They're kind of impressed with this whole thing. And I think they're, some of them are probably kind of like Peter when the angel rescued him. They think they're all dreaming. And they don't really know what's happening. And the keeper of the prison, awakening out of his sleep, and see, this is the warden, and he's sleeping, and he's got his guards over there at the prison itself. He wakes up, and he looks out, and he sees the prison doors open. And he thought, well, if the doors are open, well, that means all the prisoners are gone, and that means they're going to kill me, so I might as well kill myself, because I have failed in my duty. So he gets out his sword to kill himself, and he would have killed himself, supposing that the prisoners had been fled. But Paul cried with a loud voice, saying, "Do thyself no harm, for we are all here." I think under normal circumstances, they would have all fled. But there may have been 10, 15, 20, 30 angels that made sure that nobody left the prison. Even though they're all loose now from their chains and the doors are open, God is not going to let all these prisoners now leave. And so this jailer, who 10 minutes from now is going to give his life to Christ, kills himself 10 minutes early and ends up in the lake of fire. God's not going to let that happen like that. He's not going to let it take place in that manner. He sees this jailer's heart. And he's got this jailer in mind, and he's also building Paul and Silas's faith. And quite a number of factors involved here. Not one of them escaped. They all stayed there. So he says, do no harm. We're all here. Realize it. Realize that it was dark. And that's what the point of verse 29 is. Then he called for a light and sprang in and came trembling and fell down before Paul and Silas. It was real dark. And as he got up from his bed there, and he looked out over at the prison, saw the doors open. He couldn't see in. He couldn't tell if anybody was there. So then when he heard Paul yell out, "We're here, don't do yourself any harm," gets a light, and he runs in there, and he's amazed. They're all there. They're all loose, but they're still all there. And he'd been hearing Paul and Silas praying, and he knew why Paul and Silas had their backs all whipped and why they were put into the prison. He knew what had been going on. And he comes trembling, and God's using this to save this soul. And this is the warden, and he was the one who would have to take full responsibility if there was an escape. So it's just a phenomenal situation. Verse 30, and brought them out and said, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" And so here is God working to bring this man to salvation. Paul and Silas' attitude worked to save this man. Their singing worked to save this man. The earthquake worked to save this man. And the prisoners not escaping worked to save this man. And now as Paul and Silas preach the gospel to him, he gets saved. This is quite a day. This is not what we would normally expect. How can God take this miserable situation and do this tremendous thing? God gives us a big smile and says, "'Twarn't nothing. No problem. Easy for God. No big thing for God. All he needs is people that will put faith in him. That's all he needs. And it's not that demanding. He says, little teeny mustard seed of faith moves mountains. He's not really asking that much of us. He really isn't. Especially when we consider who he is. Not really asking that much. He doesn't ask us to do the impossible, so to speak. And even where we'd say it is the impossible, he says, I'll do it. I'll be your strength. I'll work in you both to will and to do of my good pleasure. Verse 31, and they said, believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, and thou shalt be saved in thy house. And when he says thy house, it does not mean that his salvation is that which would directly save his family in and of itself. There are a lot of people who use this verse, and they claim it. And they say, this then means my family will get saved because I got saved. See, here's the son, the daughter, the aunt, the nephew, the granddad, whoever. And he says, because I got saved, then God's going to save my house. That's not what the Bible says. That's not what the Bible teaches. The Holy Spirit is showing what could result from the jailer's conversion. It now becomes a very good possibility that the whole house can be saved. But each person must make their own decision. Not just because Bill gets saved that now his wife, four kids, all of his nephews, aunts, uncles, parents, everybody else gets saved. It just doesn't quite work that way. It'd be nice if it did, but it doesn't. And I think it's showing more what could now be possible. It's saying, in effect, now, if you will live for God, and he would have this question, well, what about my family? Well, the best way to at least give them the fullest chance to get saved is you just give your life to Christ, and then just see what God will do with that. That's much more what his point is. Now, it could be, in a certain sense, I don't think this is a proper explanation, but I offer it as a possibility. It might be more, just in this case, as more a prophetic statement. It could be more a promise of God to him, and something that would further comfort his heart, and maybe further draw him. But we can't make guarantees to anybody. And I mean the guarantees where the divorcee is saying, now if I give my life to Christ, well, that mean I can remarry my wife again? And we just got separated, and I've got this problem, and if I give my life to Christ, will he heal me of this cancer? You can never afford to say yes to any of those things. And if you feel like the Lord is quickening your faith for this thing, you've got to make it clear. If you feel like, well, I think God might do this, or I feel faith that God will do this, we've got to make it clear that it's what we feel about it. Mm-hmm. We can't make guarantees when we don't know. What happens when he dies, or the cancer keeps getting worse, and then he gets discouraged? And then he blames God, blames you, blames other people that gave him these false hopes. We've got to make sure what kind of guarantees we give people. I can guarantee if you give your life to Christ, he'll do the best that he can for you, but I don't know what the best is. And overall, his will is to heal, but I don't know what he'll do in this particular case. And we've got to be careful with the guarantees we give to people.
Yeah.
Very, very careful. It's a very serious matter.
Yeah.
If people make wrong guarantees to us, it's going to give the devil an advantage, a very real advantage. And we don't want to be used in this kind of a way by certain demonic spirits. We have to be very careful, very, very careful indeed. And when it was day, this is verse 35, the magistrates sent the sergeant saying, let those men go. Literally, sergeants is the rod bearers. These are the officials that attended the city rulers to execute their orders. These are the henchmen of the city rulers. And they were the sergeants. They were the ones that doled out the punishment. And I don't think it was a job that took a whole lot of brain power. Took a lot more brawn than it did brain. And so they come now saying, let these men go. They're the rod bearers. They're the ones used in carrying out the punishments. And then verse 37, Paul says, though, they have beaten us openly, uncondemned, being Romans. Ooh, that was not music to their ears. And have cast us into prison. And now do they thrust us out privily, in private, secretly? Nay, verily, but let them come themselves and fetch us out. Paul wanted proper public vindication for the sake of his own personal reputation. No, that's not it. For the reputation of the new church at Philippi. He wanted public acknowledgement that they had been wrongly treated. He wanted a front page report, primetime news coverage that they had been beaten and put in prison wrongly, and all public officials would sign on the dotted line and admit that that was the case. And that was so that the church at Philippi could go on with a good reputation. Because how many people know that this was done wrongly? Small, small percentage. Because don't you know? If anybody gets whipped like this and thrown in prison, they had to have done something wrong. And that's the way the majority of the people think about it.
Mm-hmm.
The majority of the people are so slow of mind and so shallow of thought, they don't realize how many people are being accused of things that they never even had any contact with.
Right.
They don't realize how much injustice there is, not only in America, but all around the world. The injustice is abominable. You know, we've got this so-called justice system that's supposed to be so fair. It so often proves to be so unjust. People being falsely accused all the time. Falsely accused. But the thing that most people only become aware of is the accusation, and they feel like accusations must have the substance. Sure, they've got demonic substance. They're just hot air. They're lies. But once it's been made, it's hard to get people to believe the opposite. So this is what Paul is doing here. And this is the reason why I said, you make them come down and escort us out of the prison, or else we're going to be sending a few messages off to Rome. We are Roman citizens. And he was, by birth, he was a Roman citizen, which was a very unique thing, that a Jew would be, by birth, a Roman citizen. But God had his hand upon that. He was born in a, I can't remember right offhand, we'll talk about it later, I think, but in the city, Tarsus, that he was born in, it was a Roman city. And people born in that free city of Rome were Roman citizens. Whether Jew or Gentile, they were Roman citizens. And I think there were maybe other factors as well. Verse 40, they went out of the prison and entered into the house of Lydia. And when they had seen the brethren, they comforted them and departed. Notice, here's Paul and Silas. They're comforting the brethren. And it shows that they stay up in God. And they're shouting victory. Their backs still hurt. I'm sure there was still pain. I don't think that their backs were just healed overnight. But they keep their confidence in God, and they keep comforting the brethren. And their strength is in God. Amazing to see people go through all these trials, but yet they're still the ones that are doing all the comforting. They're the ones that are still doing all the ministering. And that's the way it should be. And that's the way it should be overall with all of us. We should always be ready to encourage our brother, no matter what we're going through, instant, in season and out. But it takes a little bit more maturity, and so we've got a ways to go, but the Lord's going to get us there.
Right.
Chapter 17. Now, what we have is that there has been a church now established and encouraged in the home of Lydia, which is there in Philippi. And Luke apparently stays in Philippi. Compare 16:6, where we have we, and then 17:1, where it says, now when they had passed through Amphipolis, it's quite a unique name here, and Apollonia, and I stay up at night practicing these words. Still doesn't do me much good. So there's a change in the pronouns. Evidently, Luke stays in Philippi, and the others go on. Evidently, Paul, Silas, and Timothy press deeper into northern Greece. That is, they now travel south to go into Greece itself. As they travel south, they come into northern Greece. And they keep going further on in spite of opposition, in spite of persecution. They keep boldly proclaiming Christ. So now they travel down here, and they finally come to Thessalonica. And there in Thessalonica, there was a synagogue. Thessalonica was the most important seaport of Macedonia. It was a most fashionable and influential city. So it was a very well-known city. And it was a free city, which means that the authorities were elected by popular vote. And so the people prided themselves in their absolute independence. And that's what the problem is with Thessalonica. This is one of the reasons why they end up being less noble, far less noble than those at Berea, because of their independent spirit. They didn't want anybody to tell them anything. See, they're a free city. They can decide for themselves. It's like the people in the world, you can take everything away from me, but you can't take my pride. If we could only get rid of their pride, we could save their souls. Let's see, the independence, which in and of itself is good when you're talking about a political situation, but look at how the devil takes advantage of it. The devil took advantage of it here. So Paul in verse 2, he finds a group of Jews who had a synagogue of their own, and 3 Sabbath days he reasoned with them out of the Scripture. So for 3 straight weeks, he goes there and he discusses the topic of the Messiah by means of questions and answers. That's the idea of the word reasoned. It's a discussion, questions and answers. It's also used in chapter 18 and verse 4. And so we'll start with verse 3 next time. So we're partway through his second journey. I don't think he found it boring.
Sure kept his attention.
That's right.
Thank you.
Wow. I had a revelation on the word reconciliation there, and I looked it up. And it is so opposite to the heathen form of appeasing an angry God.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes along with enmity against God, commanding an enmity, and also goes hand in hand, of course, in relation to God. Repenting, conversion, turning.